I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
And welcome to part two of Red Handed's Halloween special.
Because at Red Handed, every day is Halloween. Although, some people have said that we might have gone a bit too far last week.
Mainly my colleagues, it seems. But no, we got a lot of messages. So I was in Iceland last week, and I was getting messages there while I was on holiday from friends and colleagues telling me that we'd gone too far, they were trying not to throw up, and lots of swear words.
Yeah. I'm never going to apologise for the swearing, ever.
No. And I also think, we thought this is what you guys wanted. I thought you wanted horrifying true crime. We haven't misunderstood you.
No, and have if we have, maybe this week is not for you. If last week was too much.
This is not the week. I would agree with that. But I also don't think we have misunderstood you because we got loads more five-star reviews this week.
We did.
It's basically just my friends being annoying because you guys love it, apparently. So we'll do some really quick five-star review thank yous before we kick off today then. So we got a five-star review from Q-Tet, who says that they typically don't like the banter between hosts on podcasts, but says that these two women keep the banter on topic and it feels like chatting with two friends. Plus, Hannah, we're really funny, apparently, especially when we get locked in cupboards. And they said that there's enough cursing to make you feel like we don't take ourselves too seriously, which is definitely true.
Yeah, I feel like I spent the first maybe 16 years of my life taking myself far too seriously. Since then, I've tried to not do that.
I think I was along the same lines, to be fair.
Good. And then we've also got Liza L33, who says that she's so happy to have found this podcast and the hosts are smart, funny, curious and passionate and excellent storytellers. So thank you very much, Liza with a Z.
I feel like I need Liza to write me like a Tinder testimonial.
Oh, what? Like when people have like reviews from their ex-boyfriend being like, five stars.
I know, just like, she's so smart, funny, curious, passionate, and an excellent storyteller. That's what guys want, right?
Please, Liza with a Z, write us our Tinder profiles.
Write us our Tinder profiles. Help. And then we have another one, which I love, because there's dot, dot, dots and connecting sentences, because the title is, "Do not be caught red-handed, dot, 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 in the review, dot, 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 without this podcast on your playlist."
Oh, the suspense.
I know, I love it. Because it's delightfully snarky, yet still respectable, and we're a new favourite. I love this new word, snarky. I don't use that enough.
Snarkzilla, yeah.
You do, you like that word. I never use that. I'm more a salty, sassy.
I hate that word.
Salty's my favourite, salty's my favourite. At work, everyone's just like, you're so fucking salty. Am I?
Okay, and then we've got Kate Decker, who says that she created an iTunes account just to rate this podcast, which is so sweet. Thank you so much. Reviews are really important for us to climb the charts, so please keep leaving them. Creepy true crime stories told by two hilarious ladies with adorable accents. And I feel like I'm sitting in the room, brackets, or closet, chatting with my girlfriends, and her favourite episodes are Oklahoma Girl Scouts and White House Farm. Yeah, they're strong favourites for me.
Me too.
I think White House Farm is probably my top.
I think White House Farm is my favourite episode.
Also, I went home on the weekend, so my mum now listens, which I have mixed feelings about.
That's adorable. Yeah.
And I went to my mum's house yesterday, and I was like, oh, so I got a car in Corfu, and I did this. She's like, I know you did, heard it on your podcast.
Oh my God, you need to be careful. And also, I'm wondering, like, what's going on with mine? Like, my parents have listened to bits, but they find the swearing a bit much. I know that my granddad has listened to a couple of episodes, which is hilarious. But mainly, what happens is when I'm on dating apps, I keep telling guys I have a true crime podcast, and then they find it, and then they listen. And I'm always like, oh, so either he thought it was hilarious, or he thinks I'm fucking mental.
I'm also trying to find a new house at the moment, and I've learned that it's not the thing to lead with.
Is it not?
No.
Is it not? Oh, okay. Fantastic.
Our social media shout out of the week is to someone who's just called Jay, and their handle is JaysB1989. They said, for Christmas this year, maybe we could get two pods a week. Someone shouting fuck in my ear once a week. just isn't enough.
That is excellent.
We would love to do pods every day, but we have jobs.
We have very stressful jobs. No, but we would love to do that. And I did say, though, the Patreon is launching on Friday.
Yes!
So
yes.
Please do. We keep forgetting about it. So the Patreon
genuinely
is launching on Friday. You know, we're still working on kind of what the rewards are going to be, but they will be all clarified. That'll all be set up and ready to go on Friday. You never know. Maybe you'll get some bonus bloopers. Maybe you'll get some secret mini episodes, Patreon only. And also, actually, I know we did social media of the week, but there was another one that I thought was really hilarious from a gentleman named Kurt on our Facebook group, who said that he would love it if Hannah and I just simply read aloud from an encyclopedia, a magazine, or my favourite, just read out instructions on building things, like flat pack furniture. We'll just read out the instructions. So maybe you'll get some of that. And I reckon you can probably also, we can definitely do some uncut blooper bits because cut out a lot of stuff into these episodes.
It did, when I read that comment, it did make me think of, like, you know those like very specific porn fetish sites where you're like, I'll pay you $500 just to sit on a cake. Like, it's like,
I'd do that.
$500 to sit on a cake.
Yeah.
And send it to some creepy guy.
You wouldn't do that for $500?
Yeah, I probably would.
I mean, I just got back from Iceland. I am so broke. Do you know how expensive everything was there?
No.
I mean, everyone at work heard me shouting about this all day because it was my first day back. Guess how much a glass of wine in a bar was in Iceland?
In pounds?
Cheapest. Yeah, cheapest glass I found.
£12.50.
A week I was there. 18.
Fuck off.
No.
That is like...
fuck off, Iceland.
That's a human rights violation.
That is atrocious. And we were there on my birthday. I had one glass of wine on my birthday.
Oh, babe.
Because it was so expensive. I know. It's so miserable. I mean, it was beautiful. In three words, it was beautiful, expensive, and cold. And I did also want to tell you about how many rules of my own I broke while I was out there. Namely, one being, I felt like I was pushed to the limit because of how expensive everything was. So my friend and I, who I was out there with, we were getting public buses everywhere because it was so expensive. And we got a 6-hour bus from Reykjavik, the capital, to Akureyri, which is in the north. Everyone laughed at us. We were the only tourists on that bus, and we were the only ones that stayed on for the full length of the journey. We decided to stay there for 3 days because of how long it took to get there. And we were like, oh, we have to leave tomorrow on a 6.5-hour bus. But that night, we met two young men that we didn't know.
Were they strapping?
They were like...
were they strapping Icelandic men?
No, they weren't. They were British. They were the biggest bras I've ever met in my life. And I spent the entire 4-hour drive from Akureyri to Reykjavik calling them that, so it's okay.
Should we explain what a ra is for our international listeners?
A ra? Yeah. It's like, oh yeah. A ra. So it's that.
It's like the girls wear Ugg boots and have like giant handbags and like messy...
Messy hair. And the guys all speak like Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
Oh, we are. But Brad and Ed, thank you for not murdering us and thank you for driving us back. But I broke so many rules. We didn't know them. We met them while we were drunk. And then I got in their car the next day and let them drive me for 4 or 5 hours across Iceland back to where I needed to get.
I am horrified with you right now.
It got worse. You'll be more horrified. They listened to Disney music the entire way. And can I also say they were both army officers?
Fuck off!
No, I will not. They were these two huge army officers, like from like Sandhurst or some shit, who were just like yah-yah-yahing all the way back from Akureyri to Reykjavik, listening to Disney music. And not just listening, singing to it. It was so surreal. My friend and I just sat in the back looking at each other like, what is even happening? It was so strange.
How are you not dead?
And also because I told them about the podcast, they also made loads of jokes about murdering us, so...
Oh, that's always fun. That's fun when you're in a car with strangers.
And there was like no other cars on the road either. But anyway, that was my little story from all the rules of my own that I broke while I was over in Iceland. If any listeners from Iceland, guys, why is everything so expensive?
I bet they've got really good healthcare and schools though, hey?
They have good healthcare. They've got good schools. I mean, there's only 30,000 people. So like, if even only half of them are kids, of course you have good schools.
That's true.
There's like 12 kids to go to school. Like, that's fine. But I saw like one homeless person the whole time I was there.
I don't know if this is true, but I heard that in Iceland, because the population is so small, there is a specific dating app that will tell you if you are related to someone.
I feel like that's probably quite necessary. Yeah. I mean, my understanding is, from what I learned while I was there, is that they're all just Irish or from Norway. So they probably are really related. You're probably related to some of them.
Probably.
That's weird.
I'm related to basically everyone.
Everyone was white and blonde. And my friend and I, who is of the same complexion I am, we'd be sat in a bar. And like, I'm not kidding, the last night we were there, we were like, fuck it, let's just go on a night out. And we sat in a bar and there was just a group of like six guys, blonde guys, sat at the table next to us, just staring. And we were like, it's just because it's exotic, I feel like. And then they came over and then they were like, so my friends and I have been speaking and we wanted to know, are you from Colombia or Chile, you two? Like, I'm from England. And then he told me my accent sounded like Noel Gallagher. Like, it was so weird.
Oh my God. I think if I had to rate your accent on 1 to Noel Gallagher, it would be like minus 25.
I can't even do an impression of him. Anyway, they came here for some Halloween scares. Give the people what they want, Hannah.
I'll give you what you want. This one is very... I feel like it's very much a crime of our times. It's not as gruesome as the one I did last week. So we're leaving Poland behind. Say goodbye to Poland. And we are going to Boise, Idaho. And I feel like the only reason I even know that it even rings a bell in the back of my mind is because of this case. And it's definitely one of those cases that you kind of feel like you know in the back of your head, but you're not totally sure of it. Anyway, fear not, friends.
I don't feel like I know this
I one. Think you're going to know as we go along. I've got you. So, 16-year-old Cassie Jo Stoddart was house-sitting for her family friends, the Contreras, I think it is, who were away for the weekend. This is in 2006. They knew Cassie really well and she babysat their son often. I think they might even have been cousins or second cousins or something like that. So they were close. Like, it wasn't they were just, like, leaving their house to someone they didn't know. And this house was called Whispering Cliffs. Have you heard a more creepy house name in your entire life?
It's very Wuthering Heights, isn't it?
It is, yeah. There's actually, it made me think there's a place in the UK near Guildford called Silent Pool. Whenever I drove past it with my mum, which I did like quite often when I was a kid, like it always just like sends a shudder down your side. So I always drove past it like at night as well. Like it was, but apparently they distill gin there. So it's got some redeeming qualities. Shout out Silent Pool. I don't think I could live somewhere called Silent Pool.
No.
So, it's Friday night on the 22nd of September 2006, and Cassie Jo heads over to Whispering Cliffs after school. And around 6 p.m, her boyfriend, who's called Matt Beckham, no relation, came over as well. And I can only assume that they do what 16-year-olds do with a free house, which is probably, like, get drunk and, like, fool around a bit, probably. That's what you do when you're 16, in my opinion. Sorry, Mum.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
My sister rang me once and she was, my sister's maybe, yeah, she's 5.5 years younger than I am. She rang me and she was like, one of my friends is like paralytic, like I don't know what to do, blah, blah. We drank all of the tequila that's in the cupboard and blah. I was like, no, you didn't. That's been water since I was 15. Because you used to fill it up.
Oh dear.
Yeah, Mum, I'm sorry. So soon after, so Matt gets there about 7 o'clock and he invites two of their mutual friends from school over. And they're called Brian Draper and Tori Adamsick, which might be ringing some bells for some people listening who know this case. So they invite them around and be like, oh, like, let's watch a movie together. And they didn't stay long, however. Brian and Tori told Cassie Jo and Matt that they would rather go and watch a film in the local cinema instead, and they left. And 15 minutes after Tori Adamsick and Brian Draper left the house, all of the power was cut to Whispering Cliffs. Just out of nowhere. Blackout.
No.
Yes.
Fuck off.
Matt Beckham rings his mum and he says, can I stay the night because Cassie's scared because the lights have gone off and she's frightened. And I would be frightened too, but also his mum was like, obviously fucking not. Like, I wouldn't believe that. If I had a 16-year-old son and he'd be like, oh, like, I need to stay over in this empty house with my girlfriend because the lights are off. Like, come on.
Fuck though, that. If I was Cassie, I'd be like, fine, I'm going to grab the kid and we're both going to your house and I'll sleep in your mum's bed if I have to. I'm not staying here.
The power mysteriously comes back on and Beckham's mum comes to pick him up from Whispering Cliffs a short while after. So I think Matt Beckham's only been in this house for about 2 hours, really. Beckham rang Tori Adamsick once he got home and said that he'd left. Then Cassie was there on her own. Matt Beckham would actually be the last person to see Cassie Jo Stoddart alive. The following Sunday, the Contreras family returned from their trip and their 13-year-old daughter found Cassie Jo stabbed to death on the kitchen floor.
Oh my God, that is horrifying.
Yeah, it's a film, isn't
it? It's like Strangers, The Strangers.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that film scared me so hard.
Cassie Jo had been stabbed over 30 times and as many as 9 of the wounds were serious enough to have killed her. So this isn't like a smash and grab. They really went for it.
Overkill.
So it feels personal, doesn't it? It doesn't feel like a home invasion or anything like that. And naturally, because Matt Beckham had been the last person to see Cassie alive, the police brought him in for questioning, but soon ascertained that Cassie Jo must have been murdered after he left the house. And he was obviously with his mum. So he's got a cast iron alibi. It can't have been Matt Beckham. Then Beckham said that Tori Adamczyk and Brian Joper had been at the house as well. The police brought them in and they questioned them separately. And the pair told the police independently that they had gone to the cinema. They weren't there. But when they were asked what film they had seen and to describe the plot, they couldn't do it.
Oh no.
They couldn't do it in any detail at all. I think they knew the name of the film, but it was reasonably obvious they hadn't gone to the cinema. This obviously aroused suspicion. And then Adamczyk and Draper changed their story and they said that actually they'd gone downtown and they'd been joyriding. They'd been stealing cars and they didn't want to say anything because they didn't want to get caught. But Draper was the one to break. So this is what actually happened. Brian Draper and Tori Adamczyk, who are in the same year at school, they're all in high school together, they're all same age, 16.
Is Tori a boy or a girl?
It's a boy. They're both boys.
Okay.
They'd never left the grounds of Whispering Cliffs.
Fuck off.
They waited.
Oh my God.
They waited outside the house and it was them who had cut the power.
Oh my God. How old were they?
16.
Fuck off. What the fuck?
So they turned it back on to ensure that Beckham would leave Cassie Jo on her own.
Oh my God.
Then, once they saw Beckham leave, they cut the lights again from the circuit breaker and both of them waited in the basement, hoping that Cassie Jo would come downstairs to check the fuse box. But she didn't, because she was too afraid. She stayed in the living room. So Draper and Adamczyk put on masks and like dark clothes and went upstairs and stabbed Cassie Jo to death.
Oh my God. What?
The worst thing about this, well, it's not the worst thing, but it's the thing that makes me feel the most gross, is that Adamczyk spent the whole of the next day with Matt Beckham and he kept trying to call her. And he was like, oh, I don't know why she's not picking up the phone. And this is 2006. So it's not totally unusual to just not hear from someone for a few days. She was just in the house. She was house sitting. So it was weird that he couldn't get hold of her. So it's just so gross that Adamczyk's with him the whole of the next day. And he's like, oh man, she's probably fine.
So she was house sitting. She wasn't babysitting.
No, she was house sitting. She was the only one in the house.
Why the fuck do houses need to be sat? Why couldn't she just be at
her weekend as well, you know?
Oh my God, that is so too much. Like,
yeah,
what? That's horrifying. I vaguely recall that story, but I didn't remember, like, I didn't know it in that much detail. Like, I thought it was like strangers that had just done it. That's
it gets
horrifying.
So much worse.
Oh my God. I actually am quite scared by things like this because I'm in the house. I don't want to say that. I'm never in the house by myself.
She's got a giant dog. It'll rip your fucking throat out.
I actually do. He will.
So, Adamczyk and Draper were arrested 3 days after Cassie Jo's body was discovered. And this is where it gets really fucking horrible. They had recorded themselves. They'd filmed themselves the day before the murder, detailing their plan. And I'm going to play it for you right now.
There should be no odds against killing people. I know it's a wrong thing, but... Help. You restrict somebody from it, they're gonna want it more.
We found our victim, and sad as it may be, she's our friend. But you know what? We all have to make sacrifices. Our first victim is going to be Cassie Stoddart. She's gonna be alone in a big, dark house out in the middle of nowhere. How perfect can you get? I mean, like, holy shit, dude.
I'm horny just thinking about it.
Hell yeah.
This gets important as you get onto like Draper's defense of himself, but they are so gleeful. Like the way they're talking about it is like, yeah, we're just going to fucking kill her.
I'm so horny thinking about it. Oh my God.
And in fact, they filmed themselves just before the murder. Listen to this.
2006. We know there's lots of doors. There's lots of places to hide. I locked the back doors. That's all I locked. Now we're just going to wait.
That bit is like they're just outside her house. They're about to go in and they say the date. They say the date and the time.
You fucking idiots. Fucking idiots.
They've been planning this for however long, and they actually film, we'll come onto it later, but they film like their whole plan, like they film like the selection of Cassie and why it has to be her and like what the way they're going to do it. This is just after they've murdered her, so they've stabbed her 30 times. They come out, get in the car, and the first thing they do is pick up the video recorder, and this is what they say.
I just killed Cassie. We just left her house. This is not a fucking joke.
I'm shaking.
I stabbed her in the throat and I saw her lifeless body just disappear. Dude, I just killed Cassie. Oh, fuck. That felt like fucking real. I mean, it went by so fast.
Shut the fuck up. We gotta get our act straight.
Okay.
My God, it's like such a joke to them. They just killed like someone's daughter, sister, granddaughter. It's so bleak and it's so, they just don't give a fuck. I mean, that level of premeditation, that level of like no remorse in 16 year olds.
And it's very interesting to note that the one who says, fuck, I just killed Cassie, that's Brian Draper. That's very important to remember as we get onto the trial. During the interrogations, both Draper and Adamczyk blame each other, which is just fucking classic. Like, I mean, they're children. Like, they're gonna do that. And Draper maintained that he thought that Adamczyk was joking and he never actually stabbed Cassie. So he thought the whole thing, this is his defense, is he thought it was all just this giant joke and that he just wanted to scare Cassie. And it wasn't until it was too late, it wasn't until he realized that he was actually stabbing her, that he came to and was like, fuck, he was never joking. But then why does he get in the car and immediately say, I just killed Cassie?
Bollocks. Absolute bollocks.
In the end, it's Draper who leads the police to this enormous pile of evidence. Like, the list is literally insane. So they discarded all of this stuff in a canyon nearby. This is the list of the shit that they just found in this hole. Matches, black boots, rubber gloves, fingerless gloves, hydrogen peroxide, masks, daggers, different kinds of knives, like four or five different kinds of knives, and the Sony videotape, which I just played you, and stuff that they had tried to burn. Like, there was loads of clothes that they'd obviously tried to burn but haven't really got very far, so they just left them. Piece of black cord. It's a fuck ton of evidence. Like, there's no way you can deny that that's what it was. And the thing I just don't buy about Draper being like the follower in all of this, because he says in like interviews, like after he's convicted, he was just like, oh, like I was just a really lonely teenager and he was my only friend and I just wanted to go along with
bollocks.
What he was doing. But I mean, I get that people get carried away, but come on. That it's too much. Obviously, like, murder is bad, but like, they didn't even do a fucking good job. They left a shit ton of evidence. They didn't have their alibi straight. They couldn't even describe the film. And in the videos they have like running up to the murder, like detailing how they're going to do it, they describe Ted Bundy as an amateur and like they're going to be way better than him. Yeah, exactly. They wanted the fame. They wanted to be like super serial killers. And Draper admitted in police interrogations that he was much more interested in Columbine, but Adamczyk wanted to do a Scream murder. Mm. So he was like, oh, well, I don't want to be on my own, so I'll just go along and do his Scream thing.
How did these two find each other?
They went to school together.
No, I mean like cosmically, how did these two find each other?
Well, this is actually a really, because like in the one of Draper's interviews, he says, you know, no, like me and Tori were just interested in the same things, like death and murder. And I, like, when I watched that, I was like, I'm gonna have to
I will only make you come out and get very drunk with me, never ever to murder someone.
Well, this is the thing, like, I can understand. I used to play loads of pretend games when I was a kid, and like, it's really serious at the time, but like, I mean, not when I was 16, but like, it's, I can understand
this is that beyond getting that.
It's completely beyond
premeditation. It's just, it's mind-boggling though. It's in two people so young, but hey, look at school shooters, look at things like that. Look at what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a school shooter, but then
apparently, like, this Cassie Joe was supposed to be the first one, and they were planning like a Columbine-esque massacre. So Draper in the police interviews gives it all away. He gives a full confession, blah blah blah. Tori Adamczyk, all he says is, I want to speak to an attorney. And that closes down questioning then. There's nothing they can do. They had separate trials, and both of them were sentenced in 2007 to life without the possibility of parole on one count of murder and one count of conspiracy to commit murder. And they're severely disturbed. And do you know what it made me think of? It's like, have you seen that Marilyn Manson interview in Bowling for Columbine?
I have watched that, but I can't remember.
There's an interview with Marilyn Manson, like, reasonably recently after the Columbine shooting, because there was all that thing of it being, like, linked to his music. And
are you thinking of the Devil's Not Kids? The Memphis Three?
No, it's definitely Columbine. And they do this interview with Marilyn Manson, like, wanting a comment on Columbine, and he was like, I just would have listened to them, because clearly nobody was listening to these kids. And that's why it got to the point it did. And it's actually interesting, Cassie Jo's family sued the school district because they said that they should have seen it coming. Like, surely there should have been signs. Like, how did it get to the point where they're planning a murder? And they're filming on school grounds. They're filming each other being like, this, we've chosen Cassie. They get her to wave at the camera.
Oh my God.
How are they filming on school grounds, planning a murder? No one at the school even thinks something might be a little bit wrong.
It's shocking. That's a truly, truly horrifying case. And fuck. Thanks, Hannah.
You're welcome.
Right. Is it me?
It is you.
Okay, right, guys, I'm going to warn you at this stage that this is very brutal. This is very, very Saw-esque. It's body horror. This is not a fun episode.
Is it worse than Martyrs?
Yes.
Oh, God, okay.
It's one of the worst things I've ever heard in my entire life. Okay?
Ready.
In last week's episode, I chose one that there wasn't much information about, and that's why I chose to do it. This one, there is loads of information out there, but I wouldn't want to talk about these sick fucks for an hour. So we're going to keep it to about 20 minutes, and that's what I'm going to do, because they don't deserve more airtime than that. They were a quote-unquote satanic cult led by a power-drunk egomaniac, and together they abducted, raped, tortured, and murdered potentially up to 18 women. Now, a truly horrifying aspect of these crimes, and the main reason I chose it, was because of the sheer range of the victims that these men would target. Working, professional girl, sex worker, day, night, black, white, young, old. If they spotted you, it was over. They did not care what you looked like, who you were. You just needed to be a woman, alone, out on the streets, and they'd take you. And they'd kill you, but not before they made you suffer. It all started in Chicago in 1981 with the discovery of the group's first victim, 26-year-old Linda Sutton. And they found Linda in a field behind a motel, face down with her hands handcuffed behind her back. She was in just a jumper with her underwear down around her knees. Her body was really badly decomposed, and the only reason they found her was because somebody in the motel called the police because there was a bad smell. So go find her body. And it's horrifying to see, just lying face down like that in the ground. She had $17 tucked into her socks, and luckily they were able to identify Linda through her dental records. The post-mortem showed that she'd been only actually dead for 3 days, but had shown such a severe level of decomposition. I guess May in Chicago,
yeah, gross,
is hot. But the autopsy showed more. She had suffered horrendous injuries. She'd been stabbed 17 times. And, horrifically, her breasts had been removed.
No. I just had to check mine was still there.
Not to be really creepy, but the whole time I was typing up this case, I couldn't stop checking that mine was still there. I was really interested to understand what this kind of body mutilation actually means. And the police had no idea what it meant. So they turned to an expert forensic psychologist. And in this interview I watched with her, she explains that it can mean one of three things. It can be a paraphilia, which is like a deviant sexual practice in which people get aroused by kind of unusual objects or strange, non-typically sexual activities.
Like people who fall in love with buildings?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is. It's interesting that they call it a deviant sexual practice. Yeah, I guess like falling in love with a building is still deviant. It's not depraved. It's just deviates from normality. Or it can be symbolic. So it could be a way to defeminize this victim and to empower himself in that process. Or it can be a memento or a souvenir. I think as we go on through this case, it will become interesting because from my point of view, I think it's all three of those things based on what these guys do with it and do around this. The police struggle with this case when they find Linda's body originally, because aside from identifying Linda Sutton as the victim, they didn't have much else to go on. So they conclude, because she had the money hidden in her socks like that, that she was a sex worker. Because apparently hiding their money in their socks was a really typical practice of the sex workers that worked the streets of Chicago.
I hide money in my socks.
If you're found dead in Chicago, they'd call you a sex worker. This is what they said Linda was. And to be honest, I think it was true that that was probably what Linda was doing. I don't want to be unfair to the police because by all accounts, they did lead a thorough investigation. But as far as the situation is now, they have on their hands a dead black sex worker. I don't know how much this influenced the police investigating or pursuing this case further. I mean, we'll all be familiar with this concept of kind of the less dead when it is a person of colour, especially when it's a woman of colour, and especially if they are practicing sex work. And I don't think it's unfair to say that there are situations in which that is the case. I'm not saying that that's what happened here, because the police investigators, when they talked about this in the interviews I watched, they seemed genuinely distraught by this case. So later, actually, that same day that they found Linda, in another Chicago suburb, the police received a call and a report that a 21-year-old woman named Lori Borowski had been snatched off the street in front of the store in which she worked at. So her colleagues turn up to work, and Lori was meant to be there first, unlock, get everything set up in the store. But when they turn up, she's not there. The shop's still locked, and they think that's weird because she's incredibly punctual. And they also see her keys, her shoes, and some of her makeup just lying on the floor of the car park. Now, her colleague, smart lady, immediately calls the police and tells them that she thinks Laurie's been taken. You know, to come back to this, the difference between Laurie and Linda, the first victim, there couldn't be a bigger difference. Laurie was from a loving family. She was white. She was pretty much the opposite to Linda in every way. She was a professional working girl. She was a real estate agent. You know, it's just very, so different. The police don't even make the connection. Why would they make that connection, you know? Now, with Laurie's disappearance, the pressure was on the police because they have a family pursuing them for answers. So the police are desperate. And they even bring in a hypnotist to hypnotize people who may have been witnesses to Laurie's disappearance. So if you listen to previous episodes we've done, like the Enfield Poltergeist, you know that we don't put totally a huge amount of stock in eyewitness testimony. But I do think this hypnotist is legit. It's like a style of interviewing.
I never, ever thought I would hear you say, I think this hypnotist is legit.
Oh my God, I'm breaking all my rules. No, I'm still cynical, don't get me wrong, but I do think that...
Tell me why Mr. Magnificent is legit.
No, okay, so I have many, many problems with hypnotism. Hypnotism? Hypnotism. Like, if you look back at things like the satanic panic that happened in the 80s in America, we know that lots of those kids were put under, were hypnotized, and then they recovered these false memories. So I have a huge amount of distrust for the profession in that sense. But I do also believe that there is probably a form of interview technique which could utilize hypnotism to be able to... It's a fine line. Are you placing memories in this person's mind, or are you recovering memories?
Yeah.
So it's a very fine line. But the reason that I say this is because something interesting does come out of this. So of the people they interview, a couple of them mention that they saw a red-orange van in the area around the time Laurie's disappearance. But again, nothing came of it, and the case just went cold. I don't think, like I said, that the police even linked the two women. I mean, why would they? Over the next 4 months, though, more women are found dead in and around the kind of outskirts of Chicago, like under bridges, in abandoned like fields, things like that. Despite all that the police didn't know yet, one thing was absolutely clear. It was their bodies and their fear that this killer wanted. The attacks that these women had suffered, they increase in brutality with each kill. They were covered in violent axe marks. Their faces had been beaten. They'd been raped. And their breasts had been slashed. And in every single case, at least one of the breasts had been removed.
Oh, no, thank you.
I know. And this was no surgical amputation. And as if this wasn't enough, it gets worse. The autopsies on these women showed that the breasts were removed ante-mortem. So whilst these poor, poor women were still alive, this sick fuck was removing their breasts. The police now know that they have a violent serial killer on their hands. even though the victims all look completely different, come from different walks of life, the MO is the same. Not even similar, it's the same.
And it's so specific too.
So specific. It's horrible. So they know now that this killer is a violent sadist. This killer needs to see this kind of extreme suffering. I mean, he's someone who gets off on the pain and the terror and humiliation of others. And the police, I mean, if you're police working on this case, that's fucking terrifying, because that is going to be one of the most hard serial killers, violent criminals you're going to have to catch. Because this kind of serial killer is truly terrifying. They will not stop if you cry or scream or beg or plead. Because it's that very thing that they need from you to satisfy their deviant sexual desires.
Yeah, it's a process killing.
Absolutely process killing. And he needs to see the fear in your eyes and hear the screams while he's hurting you to get off the way that he needs to. And how this kind of killer forms, with that association between pain and violence becoming fused with sexual desire, is really interesting. And it creates this kind of most violent, most horrifying and most dangerous of killers. And whilst the police at this time thought that they just had a single serial killer on their hands, little did they know the true extent of what they were really dealing with. By this point, several women have been found dead, but with each kill, the police are still no closer to identifying the killer. And truly, imagine the range of victims. There was just no correlation. Serial killer investigations, anyway, are the hardest investigations to carry out. Now throw into the fact that there is no link between the victims. I can empathize with why this was such a difficult case.
Oh, definitely.
And this is why I chose it again, because it's that, imagine the fear if you were living in that time as a woman. It could be anyone, anytime, anywhere, just disappearing and turning up having been brutalized in the most horrendous and ritualistic way. It's barbaric.
It is, that's the word, it's barbaric.
But with the police completely stuck, even with the number of victims that were turning up, they finally get a real lead. So almost 15 months after Linda Sutton, the first victim's body, was found, another woman, another black sex worker named Beverly Washington, was found in Chicago. Once again, she had faced a desperately vicious attack. She had been beaten terribly, and her breast, just like the other victims, had been removed. But shockingly, she was still alive.
What? No.
Yeah. So Beverly's rushed to hospital in a very serious condition. She couldn't speak, which is understandable. She was completely terrified.
I bet she bloody couldn't.
But the police need to hear her story. And so they go to try to speak to her. And seriously, how brave is she? Completely astonishing to me that she found the strength. She couldn't speak to them, but she wrote down a detailed description of the man who attacked her. And the story she told the police shocked even the most seasoned police officer. And honest to God, I could barely read this at first. She said that while she was working, a man grabbed her, handcuffed her, and forced her to swallow a handful of pills. Then she described a truly nightmarish attack. This man took a length of piano wire and wrapped it around her breast.
What?
And pulled and pulled and pulled. And she said that at this point, the pain caused her to pass out. And when she woke up, she was in the hospital and her breast was gone.
Oh,
it gets even worse.
How can it possibly get any worse?
You're going to have to wait for that bit. So she says that he abducted her in a red van, just like the hypnotist people told them. She was able to give them more information. So she said it was a really old red van with feathers hanging over the rearview mirror on the inside of the car. The van looked just like the van, as I said, described by the eyewitnesses from the disappearance of Laurie Borowski. So the police now finally have a vehicle to look for. And in the meantime, they also miraculously find Laurie's body in a suburban cemetery. Now, as expected by this point, she was also found missing a breast. So the connection was finally made. 10 days later, there's another break, which is just like absolute miraculous break. In Chicago, two police officers spot a red van matching the description given by the survivor driving down the street. They are like, this can't be happening. They pull over the red van. And inside, driving the red van, is 21-year-old Edward Spritzer. Spritzer is immediately nervous looking. He looks terrified. The police are, therefore, rightly completely suspicious of him. And he tells the police, though, that the van doesn't belong to him and belongs to his boss, Robin Gett, a local carpenter and electrician. So the police go looking for Gett. And as soon as they see him, they again know that this man, Robin Gett, matches perfectly the description given by Beverly Washington as to the man who attacked her. So they take him in. And during questioning, he's totally calm. He says he was home with his wife that night and he couldn't have done anything. He had no knowledge of what they were talking about. But the police know that they need to put him in a lineup. But Beverly is still in hospital. So they take Get to the hospital.
That seems incredibly unethical. Just gonna flag that.
It seems a bit much, but she points him out, she identifies him immediately, and then she collapses and they have him. So the police, they take him in, they know that it's him now. The van, the, you know, positive ID from Beverly. But for some reason that I just cannot understand, given that he was in custody for a violent and horrific attack, I'm under suspicion of being a fucking serial killer. He was released on bail.
I know I have spoken about this before, but I hate the idea of bail in general. It's wrong that you can pay to get yourself out of prison. It's wrong. I don't agree with it. It's wrong.
Don't understand. But he was released. Especially for a crime like this. It's not like he was nicked for fucking stealing a car or something. They had him under suspicion of being a serial killer and they let him go on bail. And what do you think happened? Predictably, he disappeared. Of course he did. So now again, they're fucking looking for Robin Gett. Why did you let him go? So then, just days later, another sex worker comes forward, claiming that Gett has attacked her. The police are now once again hunting Gett, and it's just so stupid. But in doing so, they turn their attention back to his employee, Spritzer. They feel like just because of how nervous Spritzer was when they pulled him over, does he know more than he's letting on? So they interview him for hours, and Spritzer is weak. He breaks. And what he revealed was more dark and sinister than anyone could have imagined. Again, I feel like it's really similar to my case last week in that parts of this almost seem beyond belief, but it's all true. So Spritzer tells the police that they abducted these women for ritualistic purposes. He said that he would help Gecht kidnap and stab them and that Gecht would then cut off their breasts. He then shocked the police further, and this is the bit of the crime that is just truly horrifying. Are you ready?
No, I'm so unready, but go on.
He told the police that Robin would then have sex with the wound on the woman's chest.
What?
I know.
I'm gonna say it, that is the worst thing we've ever said on this podcast.
It's horrifying. So he'd stab the place where he'd cut the breast off and then have sex with that. I don't even know if sex is the right word. I mean, like, he'd masturbate into it. You don't have sex with that. I'm really sorry, guys. I'd already picked this case and I didn't have time to change
it. It's fine. We're in this deep. Just keep going.
I know. I mean, just what the fuck? And then, if it's even possible at all, it gets even weirder. So what are they doing with the breasts that they remove? They, according to them, use them in ritualistic ceremonies. They're just such fucking losers.
For God's sake.
This whole Satanist bullshit, for a start. I'm not a religious person at all, in any sense. But if you want to follow any religion, let Satanists have their religion. But if you really actually read the Satanic Bible, it says not to kill people in there. That's not what Satanism and the Satanist Bible is about. The Satanic Bible written by LaVey is not about murder and torture and rape. These sick fucks do what so many people do, is they take something, it could be anything, take some book that was written thousands of years ago, or hundreds of years ago, or Scientology tens of years ago, and then use it, twist it to do what they want to do, and then claim that they're acting in a higher purpose. These sick fucks were not acting with a higher purpose. They were doing exactly what they wanted to do, and they were trying to justify it using some external means that were larger than them. So I won't, when I say quote unquote satanic, is because that's bullshit. These were sick, crazy fucks.
Yeah, I agree with
so
you.
Anyway, what they would do is they would go up to Gek's attic with the breasts that they would cut off. They would put them in a box that was like covered again in quote unquote satanic carvings, but it's basically just like pentagrams and upside down crosses and like pictures of goats. And they would kneel around a table and chant. And once the chanting was complete, they would masturbate into the box on the breast. It gets worse. And then they'd cut up the breast and eat it.
With their business on it?
Yeah.
Oh God.
And this is all 100% true. Yeah, welcome to what I was doing before I went on holiday. It's awful.
I'm speechless. Like, I can't comment.
It's like it's not real. If they made a movie of this and I didn't know it was true, I'd be like, what sort of tacky bullshit is this? You've gone too far.
Yeah.
And it's so unbelievable. It's so hokey.
Yeah, that's it.
But this is true. This is true. So Spritzer, he's the one telling them all of this because Gecht is, you know, they haven't found himself. They've got Spritzer. He's confessing to all of this. So Spritzer confesses to the murders of 7 women. And also implicates, which is now interesting, another man, 19-year-old Andy Cocorales. They know Gecht is involved. They now know Spritzer is involved. And now Spritzer implicates Andy Cocorales. So the police are baffled. They thought they were just looking for one maniac. And now they have 3. And also, these police officers in the Midwest, in Chicago, yes, it was probably a gritty city with lots of high crime. But all of the interviews with these police officers, they are just like, what? How do you even begin to process a crime like this?
It's the process of coming up with it. Like, it's someone thinking, like, do you know what I really want to do? And also, what I always find really the most horrifying is when you're watching these people in their police interviews admitting to these absolutely horrendous things they're doing, and they're talking about it like they're reading a shopping list.
The level of disassociation in this is so high. So they now have these 3 maniacs, and Cocorales admits to everything, including the fact that all 3 of them, so him, this Andy Cocorales, and Robin Gecht, all had sex with the stab wounds with the women they killed. What the fuck? So to find out more about Cocorales, the police now interview his brother, Thomas, who now also fucking implicates himself.
What?
So now there's 4 of them.
I don't want to believe that there's that many people in the entirety of the world that want to do something like that, let alone fucking Chicago.
I know, but I feel like this is why I called it a cult. Because and we'll come on to this later, but I really feel like this was Robin Gecht's dream. This was Robin Gecht's vision. But we'll come on to that in a sec. So Thomas Cocorales now also implicates himself by describing in detail how they abducted, raped, and removed Laurie Borowski's breast. He then confirms that all 4 of them had sexual intercourse with the wound. I mean, again, it feels weird to say. I feel like masturbated into it is more correct. And then he said that they hacked her body up with an axe and dumped it in the cemetery where she was found. Now, Thomas Cocorales said that the removal of the breast and the sexual activity with the wound was all Gecht's idea, but admitted that he also took part in it. And this is what I mean. I feel like it was the ultimate control, because there is no way I can see that randomly all 4 of these men had this type of paraphilia, this kind of deviant sexual desire to act out this very bizarre behavior. This was Gecht's perversion, I feel like. He got off.
And how much older is he than that?
No, he's not. He's not that much older. He was like 26 and they were all like 21, 18, 19. Like, not that much.
Oh, God.
But I feel like Gecht got off on doing it himself. But I feel like he probably got off even more on being able to control these other men into doing something so perverse, so depraved. Imagine that. This is why Gecht, to me, is so terrifying, because he transcends a quote-unquote normal serial killer. He needs to watch others under his control commit vile acts as well. He doesn't just act solo and do these horrendous things and keep it a big secret. He grooms these up, and I'm not excusing their behavior, fuck no, but he grooms these other men into this and then gets off on the, like, power of making these men commit what would make any normal person run. And I really feel like that has a lot to do with this, and that's why I call it a cult, and that's why it's not satanic. This is about one sick sexual sadist who was somehow charismatic, powerful enough, whatever it was, to form a cult of these 3 other men and go on this killing rampage. So what is truly horrifying, though, based on all of this, is Gecht was never charged with murder.
What?
Just with attempted murder. And guess what? He'll be eligible for parole in 2042. At the age of 89, but still.
Is it like a Yoji Obara situation where they couldn't prove that he'd actually done any killing?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
And he still maintains his innocence to this day. But Spritzer was sentenced to death, but then it was later commuted to life imprisonment. Andy Cocorales was sentenced to death and executed in 1999. And that is, my friend, the story of the Ripper Crew of Chicago. Now, before we go through this, when I said at the start, they may have been responsible for the deaths of 18 women, it's because there were so many bodies. They think there may have been so many more that they didn't link to this because they feel maybe the MO was developing. I felt like we spent a lot of time talking about them, and we do know the names of at least 4 or 5 of these victims. So Linda Sutton, who was 26 years old, was the first victim. Then the second victim was Laurie Borowski. The third victim that we know of was Shuey Mack. The fourth victim that we know of was Sandra Delaware. And another victim we know about is Rose Davis. And the final victim, the one who survived, was Beverly Washington, who led them straight to these men. Now, before I close this case out, I have a really interesting fact that I feel like...
Is it going to make me feel better or worse?
No, I feel like it's going to... It's not going to make you feel better or worse, but it's going to make you absolutely freak the fuck out. So, are you ready?
Yeah, born ready.
So, Gecht, as you may recall, was an electrician and a carpenter.
Yeah.
Guess where he learnt his craft, so to speak? Mr. Robin Gecht worked as an apprentice at PDM Contractors, the company owned and run by none other than Mr. John Wayne fucking Gacy.
Fuck off with your entire life. Oh my god.
And if you remember about the John Wayne Gacy case, the police always suspected that he may have had a young male apprentice or someone helping out with the murders. That he had a young male accomplice.
I remember that. I was at a party the other day and I just started talking about John Wayne Gacy in like a very casual fashion.
Classic.
And everyone was like, wait, who's that? And I just assume that what? Everyone knows John Wayne Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy. I feel like they're the basics. They're like 101.
I know that, hey guys out there, everyone who is a true crime fanatic knows who John Wayne Gacy is. But I feel like we also attract the casual listener. The casual true crime audience who maybe doesn't know who John Wayne Gacy is, as unbelievable as that is. So quick rundown, John Wayne Gacy was an American serial killer and rapist. He was born in 1972, died in 1994, and in that time he sexually assaulted, tortured and murdered at least 13 teenage boys and young men between 1972 and 1978 in Chicago.
I guess where he kept the bodies, friends? In the walls and floor of his house.
Yeah. They found another victim as recently as this year. They were able to name them as a victim of John Wayne Gacy. And John Wayne Gacy ran a contracting company. A very respectable man from the outside. He was a politician, ran a business.
He also managed a KFC for a bit.
He did. Took in loads of young boys and young men to work on his building construction business. One of which was Robin Gecht, the leader of the Ripper Crew sex cult. Sex cult, Ripper Crew cult.
That's like serial killer LinkedIn.
I thought that you, that's why I saved it to last. I thought you would find that really interesting. How horrendous is that?
Ugh.
Yeah. So guys, I feel like we've really thoroughly done a number on you in terms of horrifying Halloween episodes.
Yeah, we really have.
Thank you so much to everyone who has stuck with us through these past 2 episodes. And next week, we shall return to our usual format. We'll dial it down a notch. But tell us what you think, because as hard as it is to hear these, it was really hard to research them. But we wanted to do it because, well, it's Halloween, but also because, just because of how horrendous these crimes were, these victims don't deserve to not be talked about.
So,
with that,
join us next week for probably something a bit different.
Hopefully so. Hope we haven't bummed you out too much. Go do what Tracy Clayton said that she did after she listened to our part one, which was go listen to some really happy music and chill out.
And remember to follow us on the social medias. We are perilously close to cracking 1,000 on Instagram. Ooh. And on Twitter, and you can make that
happen. You can make that happen.
Only you
and
can.
Don't forget, Patreon launches on Friday. We would very much appreciate it. We know that lots of you guys listen to loads of podcasts, and like us, you will be supporting your favorite podcast. But just for anybody who doesn't know what Patreon is, I'll just give a quick run through. So it's going to launch on Friday, and it's basically an optional subscription service. If you would like to donate $1 a month, $2 a month, $5 a month, $10 a month to us red-handed as a contribution to enjoying our podcast, you can do that if you enjoy our podcast. And even if you don't want to or can't afford to right now, that's totally fine. Please just keep listening. But if you can, it would make such a difference to mine and Hannah's lives being able to do this, just to be able to buy some more of the equipment that we need for this. And we obviously don't expect you to do that for nothing, because what we'll do is give you guys a little something back in exchange for your optional donation, subscription, whatever you want to call it, ranging from a shout out, sticker, all the way up to t-shirts, mini episodes, blooper reels. Someone even suggested a great thing where maybe if we hit $1,000, £1,000, whatever it is, that we do like a live show, like over Facebook Live or something, where people can ask us questions, hang out with us. So basically, if you join us for whatever amount you can afford, then you'll get loads of free extra goodies from your favorite girls of Red Handed. That's it.
We'll still love you if you don't give us some money.
Definitely we will. So that's it. But watch out for more information on the social medias. We'll explain it all there.
And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.